I love that sound. It's a tenor saxophone in a full sprint, a melody that keeps folding back on itself, and behind him, the same drummer and the same piano player who were making John Coltrane sound like the future that same summer. The horn player is Wayne Shorter. The tune is called Yes or No. He wrote it and then recorded it in a single afternoon in August of 1964, and then he more or less walked away from it, onto Miles Davis and to the rest of his life. Let me tell you how this one found me, because it wasn't a record store or a library. It was at home and on my double bass. I've been learning how to play the double bass for about 2 years, and through some really hard stretches that the 2 years handed me, it's been one reliable, fantastic thing. An hour a day where I get to be a beginner again, and I keep finding out things about myself that I didn't even know were there. I practice along to one of those apps that has a whole live backing band out of a chord chart, and then you can just play along. A few months ago, they posted Yes or No, and I didn't know it, but there is really something exciting about these changes, and it wouldn't let me go. Then a week or two later, I was playing a Branford Marsalis album that I love for the better part of, 30 years? And halfway through the track, my hand just stopped because I was like, this is Yes or No? That tune is Yes or No? It is such a same but different take on the song that it just hit me like a bolt of lightning. So the light went on and I had to know everything about it. So here we are today with Yes or No as today's show on The Standard. This is The Standard Show. Every week I take one tune out of the real book and I stay with it for an hour. I track where it came from, who built it, who rebuilt it, why it survived. Today the tune is Wayne Shorter's original, which changes the arithmetic a little because the man who wrote it and the man who made it definitive are, in this case, the same person. It's the same guy in the same chair on the same afternoon. So today's question is not who rescued the tune. The question is why a fast, thorny, 6.5-minute album cut with no lyric and no hit single ended up on the bandstands and music stands for the next part of 60 years. In the next hour, I have 6 recordings for you, and they do not agree with each other about what this tune is. One of them is not sure whether it's called Yes or No or Yes and No. One of them decides that the tune is really asking to be or not to be. Hold on to that. It matters more than it should. Wayne Shorter was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1933, and Newark stays part of the story the whole way through. He went to an arts high school, the same public art school that turned out a long line of musicians, and he was the kind of teenager who cut class to sit in movie theaters and draw his own science fiction comic books. This detail isn't just an ornament. The man thought in pictures and stories his whole life. And when he started writing tunes, he wrote them in the way that you would write a scene, not in the way that you just fill out a form. That science fiction habit never really left him. It's right there in all of his titles, all through the 60s, spells and far-off cultures, the sense that each tune is adorned to something strange. Where another band leader named a tune after a girl or a city or a club, Shorter named them after games and myths and things that don't exist. And it shaped how he heard harmony too. A chord to him was not just a resting place. It was a location in a story, and the story had to keep moving. There's a sense of time about the narrative. If you want a one-sentence version of what makes Wayne Shorter's tune sound like Wayne Shorter, that's it. He wrote music that always had to arrive somewhere and almost never actually gets there. He leaves you in the doorway on purpose. He came up the hard way and the normal way. The army, the music degree at New York University, then a slow climb through the New York scene. Somewhere in there, he fell in with John Coltrane. The two of them were very close in the late 50s, trading harmonic ideas, sitting up late, working through the same problems. And that friendship is the root of a misunderstanding that shadowed Shorter for years. Because they were friends, because they were both tenor players reaching in the same rough direction, a certain kind of listener decided that Shorter was the copy and that Coltrane was the original. It's a lazy thought. They were evolving and solving the same puzzles in opposite handwriting. If you listen for the difference, it's really obvious. Coltrane pours into a mold and Short is carving out his sound. The break that made him was Art Blakey. In 1959, Shorter joined Blakey's Jazz Messengers, and within a very short time, he was not just the sax player, he was the musical director. He wrote their book. He stayed for almost 5 years, which for a Blakey sideman was close to a geological age. And the later described the Messengers' whole method to his biographer, Michael Mercer, as a bish-bash, sock'em dead routine. You go out, you hit hard, you get the crowd, and you get off. And that's what really made him. It taught him how to write for an audience in a room, and it also left him wanting something the routine could not give him. There is a phrase that critic Bob Blumenthal used years later to describe Shorter's mind, and it's the best Short definition I know. Highly analytical and yet stuffed with the fantastic. That's the tension in all of it. On one side, a man who thought about harmony like a chess problem, who could tell you exactly what a chord did and how it did what it did. On the other, the comic book kid from New York who named tunes after Chinese board games and West African spells and wanted every record to feel like a story with a locked room in it. Most composers pick a lane. Shorter drove down the middle of both at once, and Yes or No is one of the clearest examples of it. It's a tune you can analyze bar by bar that still, when it's at speed, feels like something is chasing you. And the timing around Juju tells you how fast his stock was rising. Miles Davis had been trying to pry Shorter loose from Blakey for years, and about a month after this session, in September of 1964, he finally got him. Shorter walked straight into what people would call the quintet for the ages. That's Miles, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, Tony Williams, and Shorter as the chief composer, the writer who would hand the band ESP and Footprints and Nefertiti. So Yes or No sits at a hinge. It is late period apprentice Shorter and early period master Shorter in the same breath, cut in the last window before he became one of the most important musicians alive. He was just about to get very busy. This is one of the tunes that he dropped as he made his way out the door. What he wanted was space, and in 1964, at the age of 30, still technically in Blakey's band, he signed to Blue Note and started making records under his own name. And you can hear him reaching for that space almost immediately. The writing gets stranger and quieter and more particular. Nate Hentoff, who wrote the original liner notes for Juju, put his finger on it. Shorter had a kind of controlled passion, fed, Hentoff said, by ceaseless curiosity. He would leave notes out. He would let a phrase hang. He would build a whole tune out of one small harmonic cell and just turn it over and over in the light. I've been playing tracks from Shorter's seminal album called Juju. You heard Juju playing just a moment ago, and now underneath me is Speak No Evil. What Juju really documents is a musician changing lanes in public. The Blakey band had trained him in hard bop, that punchy, blues-rooted, get down to the climax music. And you can still hear it a little in his solos. They built towards a peak and a wall, but the writing has already moved somewhere else. The tunes are modal instead of those fast-moving chord changes, on atmosphere instead of a showmanship, on space instead of density. That is the shift the whole era was making, out of bebop and hard bop and into something more open, modal, exploratory language that would define the rest of the 60s. And Shorter is making it right in front of your eyes, right across these six tracks. Yes or No is the track where the old style and the new one are both fully present. They're arm wrestling, which is exactly why it's the most exciting 3.5 minutes on the record. You can hear that fingerprint across everything he wrote in that stretch. On the Juju title track, the one underneath us just a minute ago, he sits in a B augmented chord and the whole tone scale that comes off it. So the harmony has no floor. It just hovers, six notes evenly spaced with no gravity. There's no way home in that tune. That refusal to get you comfortable with resolution is a Shorter signature. Other writers hand you a chord that says, okay, here it is, you've arrived, this is home. Shorter hands you a chord that says, keep going and you're going to have to guess where. So where does Yes or No sit in all of that? It's the fast one. Look at how Juju is built. The title track opens it, all whole tone, mystery, and ceremony. There's a slow film noir blues called House of Jade. There's Mahjong, named after the board game, with an Eastern tint to it. There's a closing blues, 12 more bars to go. That Shorter said he'd pictured as a drunk making the rounds of every bar in town. And in the middle of all that shadow and play sits Yes or No. The sprint, the up-tempo burner, the one track where you hear Blakey's years and the new Shorter fighting it out inside the same 3 minutes. On an album that is mostly about atmosphere, this is the one that's about velocity. And structurally, it's a little bit of a trap, which is a big part of why musicians love it and why jam sessions just dread it. Here's the thing about the form of that tune. Most standards you can hear the shape of. It's 32 bars, 4 8-bar sections. It even fits on a piece of manuscript and you're home at the end. Yes or No does not do that. The head is weirdly long. Transcribers who've counted it out come up with something closer to 58 bars, and it splits itself in two. The A section is essentially modal. They sit in a minor center, a Dorian color, a kind of open field where the harmony barely moves and the melody does all the walking. And then the bridge does the opposite. The bridge is a staircase of long 2-5 progressions, one key center handing off to the next, so you're tumbling through it just as you've relaxed into the modal part. The floor turns into a set of moving stairs. The contrast, that big open A section and a busy tumbling bridge, is the whole personality of the tune. That's the Yes or No. It is Shorter having it both ways, modal and changes, stillness and motion, yes and no. And it is fast. The original clips along somewhere around 250, 275 beats per minute, depending on who's counting, which means all of the harmonic information is coming at you at a dead run. And you don't get to think, you have to just know. This is why this tune has become a rite of passage. It's not hard to like. It's just really hard to play. Let's stop for a second and look at the size of what this man wrote. In the same handful of years around Juju, Shorter put Footprints into the world, Nefertiti and ESP and Speak No Evil, Infant Eyes and Black Nile, tunes that turned into the common language of modern jazz. The piece students can learn as a second vocabulary right after bebop. His recording life divides almost too neatly into four chapters. 4.5 years running the book for Art Blakey, 5.5 years in Miles Davis's second great quintet, 5 years co-leading the fusion band Weather Report, and then, at the end, roughly a decade fronting his own acoustic quartet. Four completely different rooms, and he was central in every one of them. Many musicians don't even get one era. Shorter got four. He had a theory about the Blue Note years that is worth hearing from his own framing. He told the magazine Jazz Forum that those records were the ABCs of what he was doing, that the compositions themselves had enough of what he called cell structure to hold together, to give a band a platform even when he didn't have a regular working group. That's the key to a tune like Yes or No. It's built from small, self-contained ideas, cells that lock into something larger, so rhythm section can pick it up quickly and still have room to maneuver inside of it. He was writing music that was rigorous and open at the same time. That's a really hard thing to do, and he made it look like it just fell out of his pocket. And as a player on this album, you can already hear the mature Shorter arriving. His tenor tone is dry, a little astringent. I always think of it as a plastic-sounding mouthpiece. It's never lush for the sake of lush. He makes oblique note choices. He's not afraid to leave space, and this is the tell. He plays melodies when he solos. He doesn't just run scales. He's not moving through the changes or the theory. He builds little tunes on the spot, takes a simple phrase, reiterates it, displaces it, and then slides sideways out of the key just when you don't expect it. That's the improviser you're about to hear tackle his own composition, and it's why the original recording of Yes or No is not just the first version, it's the argument. Think about what this form asks of the person soloing. In the A section, the open modal part, you have almost too much freedom. It has no form or structure, a handful of notes, a wild field, nothing pushing at you with its own kind of terror because there's nowhere to hide and nothing to lean on. Then the bridge arrives and the problem inverts. Now the cards are moving under you every couple of bars, two fives into one, two five, and on, and you have to know exactly where you are or you'll smear across all of the changes. So the tune is a test of two completely different muscles inside one chorus. It asks whether you can make something up out of nothing, and then four bars later, whether you can keep up with everything. Players who can only do one of those things fall apart on this one. Players who can do both sounds for a minute, a little like Wayne Shorter. That's the bar he set, and it's why this thing has never left the repertoire. The recording session itself is worth talking about because the room is almost as famous as the tune itself. It's August 3rd, 1964, Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, Rudy Van Gelder's studio, the room where a huge share of what Blue Note Records now is was cut, run by an engineer so protective of his gear that famously nobody was allowed to touch a microphone but him. Producing was Alfred Lion, the German emigre who built Blue Note on the idea that if you paid musicians to rehearse, which almost nobody else did, that the feeling of the recording mattered just as much as the notes did. Van Gelder's room is worth a word of its own because it's one of the most recognizable acoustic spaces in American music. He built that studio with a high wooden ceiling, and he got a sound out of it, this warm, close-present, cymbal-y, shimmering, and piano round and dark that you can identify blind in about 4 seconds when you're listening. Rudy Van Gelder was an optometrist before he was an engineer, and he ran his room with an optometrist's precision. He wore gloves to handle records. He wouldn't let anyone else touch the microphones, and he almost never explained how and why he was doing any of it. Half of the sound in your head when you think of 1960s jazz is actually the sound of this one man's living room size studio in New Jersey. And then let's talk about the band, which is part of what got people talking. Shorter did not bring his own working group because he didn't really have one yet. He brought John Coltrane's rhythm section, which is McCoy Tyner on piano, Reggie Workman on the bass, and Elvin Jones on the drums. At that exact moment, those three men were the engine of the most talked about band in jazz, the Coltrane Quartet, and here they are on a Wayne Shorter record instead. This is a loaded choice. Shorter spent a chunk of the early 60s fighting a lazy piece of received wisdom that said he was a Coltrane imitator, a younger man chasing an older man's sound. Hiring Coltrane's own rhythm section could have looked like proof of that charge. Blue Note's own writers reach for a nice phrase about how Shorter plays this particular tune. They called it yin-yang, a conversational tone that keeps getting interrupted by a kind of argumentative snarl. The controlled passion Henthoff was talking about made audible. Jordan will lay out a calm, almost spoken sounding phrase and then bite down on the next one. And the tension between the two modes, that reasonable voice and the one that has had enough, is a lot of what makes the solo grip you. He is arguing with himself in real time on a tune called Yes or No. A man playing both sides of an argument at once is either a coincidence or a really good joke. It did the opposite, and Yes or No is a good place to hear why. Put Coltrane in a modal vamp and he tends to climb like walls and sheets of sound, up, 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 searing away. Put Shorter on his own modal vamp and the wide open A section of this tune, and he does something almost contrary. He's concise. He picks one corner of the scale. He plays a phrase and then he plays the phrase after it. And he lets Elvin Jones fill in that space with those rolling, surging waves that made Jones the most imitated drummer of the decade. It is the same personnel that served Coltrane, pointed in a completely different sensibility. Same paint, different picture. It helps to know what kind of label Blue Note was, because the label is part of the sound. Alfred Lion and his partner Francis Wolff were two Germans who fled the Nazis and built in New York the most particular jazz label in the business. Their heresy, and in the record business, it really was heresy, was that they paid musicians to rehearse before the session. Everyone else just booked the studio, ran the tune cold, and printed whatever happened. Lion paid for the day before, so by the time the tape was rolling, the band already knew the music they had in their hands. When Shorter brought in a tune with a 58-bar form and a bridge full of moving changes, this was the label whose whole method was built to give a band like Coltrane's rhythm section time to actually absorb that. The other quiet decision was that there is no second horn. On most of the Blue dates, Shorter had a trumpet next to him. That's Freddie Hubbard or Lee Morgan. Not here. Juju is a quartet, tenor and rhythm, and that means two things. It means Shorter has nowhere to hide, no frontline partner to trade the weight with, and it means McCoy Tyner gets a whole harmonic space to himself. On Yes or No, after Shorter has had his say, Tyner takes it, and you can hear the enormous left hand and those cascading right hand runs pushing the tune even harder. The quartet was not really a safe choice. It's an exposed one, and Shorter took it on purpose. I've got to keep coming back to Elvin Jones on this track, because a tune this long and this fast is really a drummer's problem before it's anybody else's. Somebody has to hold the whole shape in their body, where the modal part ends, where the bridge turns over, where the top of the form comes back round, and do it at a sprint without ever sounding just like a metronome. Elvin does not count the form. He rises to it. The big triplet swells. The way the ride cymbals seem to be three or four things at once. The sense that the pulse is a wave rather than a click. That's what keeps Yes or No from flying apart at the tempo. Take Jones out and you got a hard tune. Put Jones in and you have a piece of architecture that breathes. One more thing about that afternoon, because it sits inside an almost unfair stretch of months. Shorter cut Night Dreamer in April of 1964, Juju in August. On Christmas Eve of the same year, he went back into Van Gelder's and recorded Speak No Evil, which a lot of people will tell you is his masterpiece. And in January of 1965, he walked into the studio with Miles Davis to begin ESP. So the man who wrote Yes or No was right then living two lives at once. Leader on a Blue Note by day, sideman in the most important band in jazz by night, writing at a level almost nobody sustains for that long. Yes or No is not a peak he climbed towards for years. It's an afternoon, one afternoon inside a run where he could apparently do no wrong. The facts move fast here, so I'm going to as well. Juju came out on Blue Note in July of 1965, catalog number BLP4182. The stereo copy is 84182. A record cut in 1964, held and released the next summer. Six tunes, all shorter originals. Yes or No is track 5, the second tune on side 2. It was never a single. There is no chart position, no film, no cover in its first decade to speak of. This is a jazz album cut for a jazz label, and it lived at first exactly where jazz albums lived, in the collections of musicians and the people who listened, like musicians. So how does a tune like this become a standard? Because it didn't come the way other tunes did. Stella by Starlight came from a movie. All the Things You Are came from a Broadway show and 100 singers. There is a machine for that. It's sheet music, radio, crooners. Yes or No doesn't have any of that to lift it. It has no lyric, no singer, no film, no single. What it has is musicians. It moved the way jazz originals move, hand to hand, ear to ear, off the record and onto the bandstand. From one player who owned the album to a student who transcribed the solo to a rhythm section that called it at 2 a.m. because everybody in the room knows it. This is a slower, stranger kind of fame, and it's the only kind this tune ever needed. The publishing tells you who was in charge. The tune is registered to Miyako Music, which is Shorter's own publishing company. He named his company after the people in his life, and he kept the rights really close. That matters later when this tune starts showing up in fake books and on bandstands because unlike a lot of standards from the songbook era, there was never any real doubt about who wrote it or who owned it. This is Shorter's through and through. As for how it landed at the time, Juju was admired, but not worshipped. The critics who kept the scorecards, that's Richard Cook, Brian Morton, the Penguin guy that a couple of generations of collectors treated as gospel, gave Juju 3.5 stars out of 5, a notch below the 4 they handed Speak No Evil a few months later. So even the people paying closest attention filed this album at first as a very good rather than an essential Shorter album. That's worth sitting with because it's a reminder that standards are not always born as obvious. Nobody in 1965 circled Yes or No and said, yeah, that one. Players are going to be sweating over that one at jam sessions in 60 years. It earned it the slow way. And then there's this name. On the original album jacket, the tune is Yes or No. Or. But by the time it passed through enough hands, enough lead sheets, enough re-releases, you start seeing it as Yes and No. And one word and the meaning flips. Yes or No is a demand. Pick one, it says. Yes and No is a shrug. It's both. We will come back to this because a major label saxophone star put the and version on record, and the most widely printed fake book in the world cannot keep its own story straight about which one it is. For now, just file this tune with two names, and nobody sent out a memo about which is correct. Here's why I can't let that go. The two titles describe two different pieces of music or two different thoughts behind a piece of music. Yes or No is a question that wants an answer. It says decide. It says pick one. Yes and No refuses a question. It says I am both, not one or the other. Why are you making me choose? And the tune itself, remember, is built exactly on that refusal. The wide open modal section and then the busy changing bridge, stillness, motion, jammed into one form. It is modal and it is changes. It's a burner and a puzzle. So whichever title you land on, you're only ever half right. And I think that's the most honest thing about it. Some tunes are a statement. This is one that's a shrug that happens to swing really hard. it is. This is the definitive Wayne Shorter recording of Yes or No. There's the whole thing, and then we'll talk about it. And a half minutes, and notice what he does not do. He does not build the way you expect a burner tune to build. He gets to the top of that solo, the place where Blakey Messenger would just wail and take the roof off, and Shorter does something odd. Near the end, he just half surrenders, drops into a chill, catches his breath in octave jumps, and then finds a brand new melodic pattern in the last 30 seconds. Van Gelder just fades the band out while they're still exploring it. It never resolves. It just kind of evaporates into thin air, and that's the shorter ending. He would rather leave you with a question in your hand than give you a firm period. And do not sleep on Reggie Workman down at the bottom, because in a pianoless feeling texture like this, that's just one horn, one second voice up front, the bass is doing double duty. Workman has to keep the harmonic ground honest under the open modal sections and then move really fast and clean through the bridge, all while feeding Elvin the pulse and giving Tyner something to push against. He is elastic where he needs to be and immovable where it counts. That is the thing about this recording that repays a fifth and sixth listen. It sounds like four individuals taking real risks, not a leader plus backing. Nobody is comping this on autopilot. Everyone is exposed and flying and committed. The personnel, again, because it's the engine of the thing, is shorter on tenor, and by now you know that voice, that little dry, plasticky, patient sound. McCoy Tyner following him up on two-chorus piano solo that matches the tempo without sounding rushed. Reggie Workman underneath, elastic, keeping the modal field wide open. And Elvin Jones, who is not so much keeping time as generating the weather, on a tune this fast, with a form this long and this deceptive, the drummer is the one. He's the one holding the whole architecture in his head, and Jones does it while sounding like he's just having the time of his life. Start with the melody itself, because the head tells you what kind of tune it is before anybody solos. It comes at you in a wall of 16th notes, long, winding line that doesn't sit still or repeat itself the way a pop melody would. It just keeps unspooling, turning corners so that the first time you hear it, you can't quite predict where the next phrase is going. That's deliberate. The tune is fast and slippery on purpose. The arrangement is stripped to nothing. No intro to speak of, no setup, just the quartet starting at that peel of a melody and then diving straight into the blowing. Shorter did not decorate this one. He pointed it downhill and just let it go. Listen to how Shorter builds the solo, because it's not a straight line up. He starts almost conversational, dry, choosing his spots, and he treats the modal A sections and the busy bridge as two different rooms he's walking in between. There's a moment a couple of minutes in where he locks into a rhythmic idea and just worries at it. He just repeats it, displaces it, slides it around out of key, and it is thrilling precisely because he's not showing off his speed, he's showing off his patience. And then McCoy Tyner takes it, and Tyner does not lower the temperature at all. He comes in with those chordal voicings and those long spilling right-hand lines, and the tune, which is already fast, somehow has an urgency under his hands. Two soloists, one exposed quartet, no horn to hide behind, and neither of them blinks. Why is this the definitive version, when it is also technically the only version anyone made for years? Because it set every term of the argument. Every player who picks this tune up is playing against this recording, whether they know it or not. The tempo, the concision, the refusal to resolve, the idea that you can take a modal A section and a change heavy bridge and make them sound like one thought instead of two. Shorter didn't just write the tune. He recorded the definition of how it is to be played, and he left it there for the rest of us to tangle with. You are listening to The Standard Show on Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I'm your host, Johanna Lean. I've got six recordings of this tune for you tonight, five of them still to come. The full playlist with every personnel credit is now up at thestandardshow.com. Stay close. Version 1. That started this whole show. The Branford Marcellus Quartet from Random Abstract on Columbia, recorded in 1987, released in 1988. Branford on the tenor, Kenny Kirkland weaving havoc on the piano, Delbert Felix on the bass, Louis Nash on drums, and produced by brother Delfeo. And here's your and. They open the whole album with this tune, and they spell it yes and no. Observation. This is the most reverent version you will hear tonight, and also the one that quietly changed the tune's name in half of the world's memory. It comes out of the gate even more aggressive than Shorter, a young band in 1987 planting a flag on that Blue Note sound. And if you ever wondered why so many players called it Yes and No, it's because a lot of them learned it here. Version 2, the Dave Liebman Big Band, a tribute to Wayne Shorter, Summit Records, 2014. Dave Liebman featured on soprano saxophone, arrangement by the Swedish composer Mats Holmquist. Gunnar Malmblad directing, a full big band behind them. Complete personnel is in tonight's notes if you go online. Here is what you just heard, if it surprised you. Holmquist states the theme and then drops you straight into a drum solo almost immediately, and then horn backgrounds behind the soprano are not swinging band pads. They are looping, interlocking, minimalist cells closer to Steve Reich than to Count Basie, stacking up and building to these waves. Anchor observation, somebody took the fastest, most personal thing on Juju and turned it into architecture for 18 players. I'm still deciding how I feel about hearing Shorter's Private Spin played by a small army. What do you think? Version 3, and it's a bit of a strange one, the Luca Gelli Organ Trio from the album called Shorter Notes, released in 2024 on the Italian label Dodecalune. The personnel is the surprise. That's Luca Gelli on guitar, Manico Seghi on Hammond organ, Giovanni Paolo Liguori on drums. No saxophone, on a Wayne Shorter tune. The whole story here is grief and nerve. Gelli is a Florentine guitarist and teacher who started the Shorter project just before Shorter died in 2023, finished it after, and cut it in the studio in Tuscany. Instead of reaching for reverence, he reaches for grease. A smoky, soul jazz, Hammond B3 treatment, guitar carrying a line that Shorter wrote for his own tenor. It shouldn't work. You've taken the no floor tune and given it grounding. The greasiest floor in jazz, the organ trio. But I think that's the whole reason why they're playing it. Thank you. Version 4 is Sonia Schiavone from the album Wayne Shorter's Legacy. It's on Da Vinci Jazz from 2022. Sonia Schiavone on voice, Fabio Gorlier on piano, Stefana Profeta on double bass, Donata Storfli on drums, Gianni Veroni on tenor saxophone, and there's a small horn section backing them up. She is a singer from Turin, and she did not just sing the tune, she wrote words for it. And I do believe that vocal jazz is part of the jazz tradition, and it's part of what has kept it alive. It is the hook that keeps us humming and singing it after we've heard it, right? She arranged the whole thing herself. Here is the anchor, and it's almost too perfect. She titles it Yes and No, and the lyric she sets to it is Hamlet, to be or not to be. She took a tune whose own name couldn't decide between the or and the and she pointed it straight at the most famous either or question in the language. The Real Book was born illegal. Two students at Berkeley in the mid-70s put it together. The melodies and the chords hand-lettered. There's no royalties, there's no permission, no lawyers. And it spread by photocopy across every bandstand in the world until it was less a book than a shared secret. For 30 years, it was contraband. Then Hal Leonard licensed the whole thing and put out the legitimate 6th edition. It looks the same handwriting, with the composers finally getting paid and the worst of the old errors have been cleaned up. Yes or No lives in volume 1 of that 6th edition on page 481. It carries its identity crisis into the page. In the C and B flat editions, it's printed as Yes or No. In the E flat edition, the very same chart is Yes and No. Same book, same page, two titles. The or and confusion is baked right into the Real Book itself. The chart sits in a minor center. The head runs long and lopsided rather than a tidy 32. And the one thing to watch at the jam is that unusual length and that it shifts from the open modal A sections into the tumbling 2/5 of the bridge. You gotta count it before you call it. People get lost in the form and not in the changes. Play it slower than the record maybe the first time. Nobody at a Tuesday jam is playing this at Elvin's tempo and living to tell the tale. This brings me to the last recording, and the recording I saved. In May of 2015, at Frederick P. Rose Hall in New York, the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis devoted 3 nights to the music of Wayne Shorter. And they did the thing that almost nobody gets to do. They invited the composer to come and play his own tunes with them. Shorter at this point is 81 years old. The recordings came out in 2018 on Blue Engine Records as The Music of Wayne Shorter, and track one, the very first thing you hear, is Yes or No. When Shorter died in March of 2023 at 89, the tributes were enormous, and they took the shape you would expect from a composer. People didn't just eulogize him, they played his tunes. That Italian organ trio you heard a few minutes ago started their whole projects in the weeks around his death out of exactly that impulse, the need to sit inside his music when the man is gone. And that's the truest measure of a standard. When the writer dies, the songs keep talking. The people who loved Wayne Shorter did not fall silent in 2023. They called Yes or No and Footprints and Speak No Evil, and they kept the conversation going. And here is the quiet engine under the whole hour. The reason why this tune outlasted the album it came from. Yes or No became a teaching piece. It's exactly hard enough. You got to play it and you have to prove you can handle that wide open modal stretch and bridge full of moving changes in the same breath. You got to flex with it at a tempo that punishes any hesitation. Music schools have figured that out, and it turns up on juries and combo classes at Tuesday night jams when somebody calls it to see who's really done their homework. A standard in the end is just a tune that enough musicians decide is worth the trouble of learning over and over, generation after generation. That is a kind of immortality you earn one bandstand at a time, and this one has certainly earned it. You have to understand where Shorter was by 2015 to feel the weight of it. After Weather Report, after the fusion years, he had spent the first part of the century leading one of the great acoustic bands of the modern era. His quartet with Danilo Perez, John Patitucci, and Brian Blade. A group that treated even his oldest tunes as live wires, never the same way twice. He'd won a stack of Grammys as an old man. He was, by wide agreement, the greatest living jazz composer. And everyone knew that the clock was running. So when the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra built three nights around his music and put him right in front of it, it's not about nostalgia. It's the institution catching the man while it still could. The credits matter here. So the arrangement is by Victor Goines, a 16-piece orchestra, Don Neimer on piano, Carlos Enrique on bass, Ali Jackson on drums, the full JLCO trumpet and trombone sections. And the solos on this track are Wayne Shorter on tenor, Munton Marcellus on trumpet, and Nimmer on piano. So the tune has come all the way around. In 1964, a 30-year-old wrote a fast private tune and buried it on side two of an album, played it once with a borrowed rhythm section, and then left. 51 years later, the same man stands in front of a full orchestra in the most institutional room in American jazz and plays it again as an elder, slower to arrive, every note chosen. That same refusal to resolve, now sounding less like a young man's hurry, more like a life's patience. Wayne Shorter died in 2023, and you got to come back and play this one first. Thank you. So that's the Standard Show for this week, and this week's tune was Yes and No by Wayne Shorter. You can always find full versions, plus a few extra versions, on the website. That's the-standard-show.com. See you next week.